Welcome to Socrates in the Studio, which is part of Socrates in the City. The city we're in is New York City. Today, my guest, I am really very happy to say, is a very dear friend, Joe LaConte. But if he weren't my friend, I would just tell you about what he's done. So let's pretend for a moment. Let's see. He is the director of the Rivendell Center in New York City. He's presidential scholar at the New College of Florida. He's the C.S. Lewis Scholar for Public Life at Grove City College. And he also serves as senior fellow at the Sagamore Institute and the Trinity Forum. He's best known for his New York Times bestseller, A Hobbit, A Wardrobe, and A Great War, How J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis Rediscovered Faith, Friendship, and Heroism in the Cataclysm of 1914 through 1918. He's written a book called God, Locke, and Liberty, The Struggle for Religious Freedom in the West, The Searchers, A Quest for Faith in the Valley of Doubt, and other terrific books that I can recommend. It's my privilege to speak to my friend, Joe LaConte. Joe, welcome.
Eric, it is terrific to be with you. A real pleasure and privilege, my friend. Great to be back.
I'm already laughing inside, and we haven't even started. You really, one of the reasons we've been friends for so long is your love for C.S. Lewis.
Yes.
I have never really been particularly familiar with Tolkien, but anytime you hang around with people who love Lewis, you're hanging around with people who love Tolkien.
Yes,
so I feel familiar with Tolkien,
yes.
If only because of his abiding and very important, as we'll see in this conversation, friendship,
yes,
with C.S. Lewis. Your new book is titled The War for Middle Earth. What is the subtitle? I don't have it in front of me.
The subtitle is J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis Confront the Gathering Storm, 1933 to 1945.
Okay, so your previous book on Lewis talks about the first war in which they fought and suffered, and this one is about them confronting the gathering storm. So you title it The War for Middle Earth.
Yeah.
I just want to ask you, when did you in your life first start reading Tolkien or getting excited about Tolkien?
You know, I didn't read Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings, until after the movies. I was actually in my 40s. I'm a late bloomer, Eric, just so you know. Right?
Yeah.
And my friends usually say, LaConte, you call this blooming? But yes, I'm a late bloomer. And I was doing my John Locke academic work over there in London. And so I'm doing John Locke during the day, and I start reading The Lord of the Rings at night in an English pub. And I thought, that's the best way to get. And I found myself so morally invigorated by the story. I thought, there is something here that I think is going to be a part of my literary life at some point, didn't know how.
Mm. Do you speak Elvish?
I'm still working on Queen's English here, man. Come on.
Have a few words in Elvish that I thought I just want to throw out.
Go ahead.
You know what they are. I just have three. I got to pronounce them correctly.
All right.
Skunjil, Mama Luke, and Jidrul. And any ringing any bells?
They're not ringing any bells, although there are certain Italian swear words we're not going to use here on air, which we all learned growing up, of course. But the Mama Luke is a good one.
But before we go too much further, you like skunjil.
Of course, yes.
You know, with a little olive oil?
Yeah.
Okay. we had to get through that.
Yes.
All right, so whenever anybody writes a book, obviously I've written books, the first question I ask, because I feel it gets into the conversation, is why did you write the book?
Yeah.
I mean, you know a lot about Lewis and Tolkien. What made you say, this is a book I have to write?
Yeah, and I never thought I'd write a second book. The first book was on the impact of the First World War on their lives and their literary lives. I didn't think I'd write a second book because there are so many good biographies out there. But then as I got more into the subject matter and understood more about, okay, what is going on in the 1930s and 40s as they are writing their great imaginative works, what the historian likes to do is to contextualize. Look at their great works and figure out what's going on politically and culturally as they're in this storm, the gathering storm, as Winston Churchill called it. And it really begins in earnest in 1933 when Hitler comes to power. And so I thought, I haven't read, of all the wonderful biographies that are out there of Tolkien and Lewis, I have not read a single biography, and maybe not even a serious scholarly article, that tries to examine their works in the context of the crucible of the Second World War. But I don't think you can appreciate their achievement unless you understand what they were going through.
Well, it's funny because there is real darkness in some of what Lewis, with whom I'm much more familiar, writes. He clearly has suffered. He knows pain. Yes. He lost his mother when he was very young, what he went through in the First War, the horror of the trenches. Yes. That's always there with him, isn't it?
Yes, but it also is with Tolkien, because he was an orphan by the time he's a young teenager. Mom and dad both pass. And he's at the Battle of the Somme in the First World War, the single bloodiest day in British military history, July 1st, 1916. Tolkien is at the Battle of the Somme. He lost most of his closest friends in war, just as Lewis did. So they carried the scars of war. And I think it's one of the things that actually drew them together in friendship. Other things, of course, their love of epic literature, mythology, right, heroic stories. That draws them together in the 1920s. They first meet in 1926. And pretty soon, pretty quickly, this deep friendship is going to emerge. But part of the point I'm making in the book is I think the Second World War creates this sense of deep urgency that they've got to get on with their callings, their academic callings and their callings as writers of fantasy fiction, because they just don't know if they're going to survive, right? From 1939, as you know, until about 1945, the survival of Great Britain is an open question. It's an open question.
You know, it's interesting, and this is because I'm an amateur historian, which still makes me an historian, but at least
I'm not going to contest that. I'm offend too many of your friends.
And I've got five honorary doctorates, which does not make me a doctor of anything. But I only say that because the idea, when you're dealing with history, we know that Hitler's defeated. We know that Churchill and England survived. Yes. Like, we know this, and it's very tough for us to entertain the idea that it might not have gone that way, or just to put ourselves in the context, as you say, of not knowing how it's going to turn out.
Yes.
That's hard.
Yes.
But it's vital, as you say, to understand these two men.
Yes.
And what they're going through, and of course, not just the two of them.
Yes.
Let's talk about that for a minute, Joe, because that's a big thing.
Yes.
That when we think of England, it does seem inconceivable to us that it might not have survived.
That's right.
It really does seem almost impossible to comprehend that possibility.
But for them, living in real time and not knowing the outcome. There's a series of letters that Lewis wrote to a couple of his friends. Dom Griffiths was one of them, where it's 1938, and it's in October of 1938. And he says, pray for me, because I was terrified to discover how terrified I was by the crisis. Now, you know, what's the crisis in September, October of 1938? It's the Munich crisis. They're living through the Munich crisis. And the sense that Britain is on the edge of another world war, there's a sense of dread and gloom in the air. And Lewis is terrified by the prospect of another war. He says he'd rather die than go through another war, but here he is.
Well, this is the other thing, too, about history and the way we perceive time.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I are pretty much contemporaries. And so for us, World War II is ancient history. World War I is 1,000 years before World War II.
Right.
To them,
right,
it was 10 minutes ago.
Right.
That is tough to fathom, that the distance between 1918 and 1938 is less than nothing.
Yes.
I mean, as we sit here, that's 2005.
Exactly. Exactly.
So it was just a moment ago.
That's right.
That they had crawled out of that abyss.
Yes.
And here they are.
Yes. Their lives are bracketed by two global conflicts, the most destructive wars in the history of humanity. Their lives are bracketed by those wars. And we cannot appreciate their literary achievements unless we understand that basic fact about their lives, right? But I don't see many authors or others really understanding that and pressing that and helping us to understand it and what an achievement it was for them to accomplish what they did in their writings in that absolute cataclysmic period from 1939 to 1945. Think about it, Eric. The Blitz on London, 76 consecutive nights of aerial bombing on the city of London, save one night, 76 consecutive nights. They're in Oxford. And so friends, family members, the evacuation of children by the thousands into Oxford. How does Lewis get the idea for The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? The evacuation of children from London because of the war to the home of a professor. That's when he first starts writing those lines during the Second World War, the opening lines to the line. So they are in the midst of the struggle. And I think for Americans, you know, we're on the other side of the Atlantic, right? We don't get involved until Pearl Harbor. And there are some British historians who think we may not even have gotten involved had we not been attacked by Japan. We were so isolationist.
I'm pretty sure that's a fact.
Wow. You do?
At least I would. I if I had to guess, yes, I would say that.
Yeah.
Well, just for me and for those listening and watching, give us the chronology. In other words, when did Lewis, or what was Lewis writing during this period, and what about Tolkien? When did Tolkien start The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings? When did that process begin?
Yeah, let's take the second one first.
Yeah.
Tolkien writes The Hobbit in around 1933. He's got the draft of The Hobbit out. It doesn't get published till 1937. And of course, you know this because you've written some successful books. Your publisher is always demanding more. Give me a sequel. His publisher wants a sequel to The Hobbit. And he initially says, I have nothing more to say about Hobbits. He literally tells him that. Nothing more to say about Hobbits. But he starts writing it again when? At the end of 1937. So from the end of 1937, right through the Second World War, he is struggling with that manuscript. And we can talk more about how the war, I think, affected his imagination throughout. Well, Lewis, think about the Screwtape Letters, for example. This is a diabolical fantasy, right? Screwtape, the demon, and a junior demon. How do we tempt and drag a human being, a human soul, you know, into the pit of hell, right? How does he get the idea for the Screwtape Letters? I think you know this. It's 1940 in the fall, and Hitler now controls virtually all of Central and Western Europe. France has fallen. No sign of America entering the war. Hitler has just given a speech, I think, on a Friday. He's triumphant. The German people will follow him anywhere. And the speech, Lewis is listening to it. It's being broadcast by the BBC and simultaneously translated into English. He's with his friend, Dr. Havard, the family physician. They're listening to the speech on a Friday, Hitler's speech. It's all about, of course, conquest and his rage, his hatreds. Lewis says, actually, in a letter to his brother, Warney, he says, while the speech lasts, it's almost impossible not to waver just a little.
Wow.
Think about that. the power of the charisma of that individual. But then he says, in church on Sunday, he gets the idea for the Screwtape Letters. Not an accident, in my mind.
Wow.
Not an accident. A diabolical fantasy. But he's going to focus on not a global conflict, but the spiritual conflict going on for the soul of every human being. Now, that's a deeply committed Christian author.
Wow.
Remarkable man. But it's the speech.
Yeah.
It's the speech. It's Hitler's speech.
I absolutely never heard that. That's extraordinary. And so when does... Well, let's go back, actually. You mentioned the friendship. I'm sure we've covered this at some point in one of our previous conversations. But, you know, 1926, Tolkien is a Catholic Christian.
Yes.
C.S. Lewis is an atheist.
He's an atheist, yep.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Their friendship.
Yeah.
They both obviously have the war in common. How did they become friends, or what began to draw them together before Lewis comes to faith?
It's a great question. One little thing that Tolkien did, you know, he's a linguist, he's a philologist. He loves languages.
Yeah, yeah.
All kinds of different languages.
Yeah.
Icelandic was one of the languages that he knew and loved because of these epic sagas that were written in the original Icelandic. So he starts a little Icelandic group, a reading group that only Tolkien would do, and he asked Lewis to join him. And I think that was the beginning of the friendship.
Yeah.
Because Lewis also was stirred by the same kind of sagas. And you get the sense that they're having this, something is happening here in the friendship. One of the turning points, though, is when Tolkien sends to Lewis his early manuscript of the story of Beren and Lúthien. You know, the human and the princess.
Wait, who sends the story?
Tolkien sends it to Lewis.
Yes, I was going to say.
It's an early... Tolkien
sends
it to Lewis.
No, I wasn't clear, so yeah.
So the elvish princess who lives eternally and the love relationship with the mortal man, he sends it to Lewis for his feedback. Lewis sends him like 12 pages of critique And in the letter that he sends to Tolkien, he says, more quibbles to follow. You know, 12 pages of critique, but he loves it. He loves the story. And he's helping to see how it could be better. Tolkien incorporates some of Lewis's suggested edits. But think about what would happen if, you know, if you'd sent me an early part of your manuscript and said, I ain't got time for that, Eric. I'm trying to read your manuscript, critique it. You'd interpret that in a certain way, right? He responds with this thoughtful critique, and you can tell that is a turning point, because what's Tolkien doing? He said that story was closest to his own life, his relationship with his own wife. It's kind of modeled mm-hmm. on that. Mm-hmm. So it's a precious story to him, one of his most favorite stories of all the legendarium. He's sharing it with his friend Lewis. It's a turning point in the relationship. He realized there's a kindred spirit.
Well, now, when you say it's one of the first, he invented the story.
Yes, Tolkien did, of course. Yes.
Okay, I mean, first of all, I want to comment on the idea of, think of a world in which people are writing stories.
Yes.
We don't live in a world where people are writing stories. I mean, it's an interesting thing to me that there existed a market or a world in which one could write a story like that. Presumably, there's an audience for that.
He's reinventing fantasy for the modern mind is what he's doing. He's writing really the first modern fantasy story. Mm-hmm. And he's showing future writers how you do it. And one of the ways you do it is you build it upon a whole history, a deep, rich, ancient history, so it has depth. Realism.
We're so familiar with that we're over-familiar with it, to the point where I realized that I'd never particularly liked reading fantasy.
Yeah.
And I think because most of it is not that good, because it's sort of trying to do what Tolkien did, but without his amazing talent.
Yes, yes.
So he kind of invented the genre.
He really did invent the genre.
I don't know that I've invented any genres. Have you ever invented a genre?
Not lately.
I mean, it's an amazing thing.
How do you invent the
genre? Where does
did?
That come from?
Well, we have to say this, and I think your audience will appreciate this. Without their education, with their classical Christian education, think about it. Homer, Virgil, Dante, Milton, this is part of their intellectual furniture.
Yeah, there you go.
And you don't write fantasy with depth without that as part of your moral literary outlook. That's part of the reason I think we don't produce
That's interesting. So to some extent, I mean, they're standing on the shoulders of, you know, Dante and Milton and Homer and whoever wrote Beowulf. Yes. We'll never know.
I think you wrote Beowulf.
Unless I think it was Mark Felt. He was the head of the FBI in the late 60s. I believe
a little side hustle.
I believe his name was Mark Felt.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll look that up on Wikipedia.
But it's just so interesting because when we think of those literary epics, that really is.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we say he invented a genre, but he really was coming out of that.
And think about this, back to the friendship, and it ties in the genre business as well. Beowulf was probably the most important literary work in Tolkien's life. He translated it.
I didn't know that.
He taught on it for decades. Mm. It was a huge part of his academic and literary life. And it's a story of this hero who's up against Grendel it's one monster after another. Raw evil, radical evil is what Beowulf is up against. Tolkien is drawn to stories of that lone, heroic quest, putting aside your own ambition, following your moral duty to save others against a radical evil. Lewis is drawn to the same thing.
You reference, The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, Screwtape Letters, The Abolition of Man, Lewis's Space Trilogy, The Narnia Chronicles. It really is interesting because there is something, particularly in the Space Trilogy, horrific, frightening.
The
Abolition of Man is similar to that, his short book, The Abolition of Man.
Yes.
There's no other word for it. It's evil.
Yes.
And they really, really, truly see the evilness of evil in a way that most, I would say, almost no writers in the 20th century do the way they do.
Yeah, maybe Orwell. Maybe George Orwell, perhaps.
Yeah.
Perhaps. But again, think about the political, cultural context. Lewis is writing the Space Trilogy, begins writing it 1938, 1939, 1940. You know what is happening. The rise of the totalitarian states. Communism, Nazism, and they are ravaging the European continent, right? So what do we get? If I could read a few lines.
Yeah.
Talking about radical evil from Paralandra now, right? The second in the series.
Yeah.
And the description of the unmanned is really, it's horrifying.
Paralandra is, you know, if somebody put a gun to my head at 2 a.m. and said, what's your favorite book? I might have to spit out Paralandra. I mean, that book is, I don't know anything that really can compare to it in the 20th century.
Yes.
But go ahead.
The temptation of the Eve character by this demonic character, unmanned. There's nothing like it in modern literature. You feel like you're in the Garden of Eden, listening to the temptation, don't you?
Yeah.
Here's a few lines. The description that Lewis gives of the unmanned. Tell me what comes to mind, Eric. It did not defy goodness. It ignored it to the point of annihilation. Ransom perceived that he had never before seen anything but half-hearted and uneasy attempts at evil. This creature was wholehearted.
You know, pops right into my head, Michael Dukakis. Oh, my
gosh. Well, in the tank shot, right, with the helmet on the campaign. You remember the campaign, right?
It is funny, though, because when you think about it, we really don't that is one of the reasons that book convinced me of the unprecedented genius of C.S. Lewis to create that picture of evil that you just read.
Yes.
It is chilling.
It's chilling, but it's not just out of his imagination, right? It's at his doorstep.
Mm.
It's at the doorstep of England in 1940-41. They're expecting an invasion by the Nazis any day, and they're trying to prepare for it, right? So there's a form of radical evil on the political stage, and this is how we, again, help to appreciate their literary achievement. Right?
Well, he's still, what's fascinating to me is the prophetic quality of Lewis. That in The Abolition of Man and in the last book in the so-called, in the Ransom Trilogy, he's talking about things, it seems very contemporary. Like he sees where it's all going.
Yes, yes.
Before, I think anyone does.
Yeah, I think that's right. The hideous strength, I mean, and the way that science and technology will be abused, used and abused in the service of what? The will to power. Well, welcome to our age, friend, the 21st century, science and technology, to dehumanize us, holding out the promise of the good life, of the perfect life. Here we are, right?
Unfortunately, I'm tracking.
he was prophetic.
So what are some of the things, some of the other things that you talk about in the course of this new book?
Well, with these men, I think we've got to try to appreciate the degree to which they felt like they had to push back against these ideologies through their writing. And I don't think that's been fully appreciated. And I've only taken a stab at it. Meaning, they're not going to just throw up their hands and say, well, totalitarianism, there it is. Modernism as a literary movement, you know, the wasteland. I guess we just have to put up with it. Famous conversation around 1936 between the two of them. Lewis is a Christian by then. Their friendship is deepening. Lewis says to Tolkien, well, Tollers, his nickname for Tolkien, well, Tollers, if they're not going to write the kinds of books we want to read, we shall have to write them ourselves. They're going to get in the game, right? And they're going to deliberately push back against these dehumanizing tendencies, both in literature, in modern literature, modern art, but also the political ideologies. And they're going to re-enchant the moral imagination, as different authors have noted, right?
Well, the reason I see them as just giants, you know, in the 20th century is because, you mentioned Orwell. Other than Orwell, I see the 20th century as an abdication of this, you know, call to arms.
Yes.
That most people in the 20th century, as you said, they just either described the decay and the horror or just rode it like a wave without, you know, what they did was unique.
It was they created what you could call a beachhead of resistance at Oxford with the Inklings, the other Christian authors that they pulled together in their ranks, Charles Williams, Hugo Dyson, and others. Tolkien, Lewis at the center of this thing. It is a deliberate haven, beachhead of resistance. And they have no idea where their writings and their scribblings are going to go. They just know they have to try to do something. And here we are talking about their works, you know, 75, 85 years later, right?
Well, it seems inevitable that unless you have a deeply biblical worldview, you wouldn't know what to make of the evil. You wouldn't even be able to call the evil evil, really. Yeah. You could just know maybe you don't like it.
Yeah.
But they seem to see to the bottom of it and to see that there is an answer to it.
Yes, and I think if I could quote from a little place here from Lewis, I think I can find it pretty quickly. It's from his radio broadcast, actually. Remember, he's giving the BBC radio broadcasts.
Yeah.
He's asked by the religious director of the BBC, Britain's at war, people need to be encouraged. This is how different the BBC was back then. We need someone who has the ability to communicate the Christian faith to our nation in ways that can be understood, right? You remember how he starts out the first line in Mere Christianity, the radio broadcast, 7:45 in the evening, 1941? The first line, which is the first line in Mere Christianity, the first line in the radio broadcast, Eric, is, everyone has heard people quarreling. Everyone has heard people quarreling. An amazing place to begin. He's trying to reach this mass audience. He's beginning with the moral law. We have a sense of how life ought to be, how you ought to behave. You're violating the norms. We violate our own norms. He starts out with the moral law, and he winds up sharing about Jesus and the great gift of salvation. He doesn't start with Jesus. He starts with everyone has heard people quarreling. What a gift, the apologist gift that he has. But he realizes that that's the great question, is the fall. Eric, Lewis keeps coming back to the doctrine of the fall in virtually everything he is writing from 1938 through 1945. He keeps coming back to the doctrine of the fall. It's in the Abolition of Man. It's in the Screwtape Letters, right? It's in the Great Divorce. It's Mere Christianity. It's in the Problem of Pain. It's all over the place. He feels like we've got to reintroduce this biblical doctrine, creation and fall. That is the clue, as he put it, the clue to the meaning of the universe, right?
It's impossible not to lament where England is today when I hear you talk about, you know, the BBC inviting him, inviting him to talk about Christian faith on the BBC to help this nation in the war effort.
Yes. To defend Christianity.
That's an extraordinary thing.
Yes. Yes.
One of the other things, I guess, that I always think of when I think of Lewis's, particularly the Narnia Chronicles and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy, is how they have lasted compared to all the other books that have been endlessly hailed as great. I mean, is there a soul on planet Earth reading Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses, who's not an academic? These books that they wrote, you know, if the world should last 1,000 years, I'm assuming, kind of like Beowulf, we will be reading these books. So the question then is why?
And I only have a partial, it's a fabulous question, I only have a partial answer to that. The enduring power and attraction of their works, how do we explain it? And I think it's a combination of things. I think it's a combination of what I said earlier. There is this great intellectual literary foundation, the classical Christian tradition, that is part of it. They're drawing on these great works, these universal themes. Mm-hmm. That's why we consider them great works. Mm-hmm. Human nature doesn't change. Heroism, cowardice, right? Sacrifice for a noble cause. Those themes are embedded in some of our great... So that's part of their background. But also, they've lived through so much. Their writing now is, it's being shaped through the crucible, especially now, the Second World War. World War I also plays a role. And I think during the Second World War, both wars are in play in their minds. Mm. How could they not be? Because it was only 20 years earlier, and they had painful memories of the First World War. I think the memories of heroism and the horror of the First World War and the lived Second World War is playing on their imagination. That's part of it. But of course, we have to say, because it's absolutely true, the Christian foundation that these men had to imbue their mythic works with this profound understanding of the human condition, our nobility and our tragedy. There aren't many writers who can do that.
Well, I mean, first of all, they have the outrageous talent. It's just an outrageous gift from God. There's no, you know, you can't make yourself more talented by hard work. You know, it doesn't work that way. Yeah. They have this outrageous talent, but their Christian worldview, it's not just a Christian worldview. It's a particularly heroic, I would say it's an authentic Christian worldview.
Yes.
It's not just the theological worldview. Because yes. What they were doing in writing these books, you know, was standing against the juggernaut of cynicism.
Yes.
When I think of the 20th century and modernism, they stood against it.
Yes.
They said, no, there is hope.
Yes.
There is truth. There is goodness. Because, it just seems to me that what makes them stand out so much
yes.
is that I can hardly think of anyone else who stood against
yes.
that, you know, juggernaut of cynicism, as I put it.
Yes.
They really were vilified by the intellectual elites for doing that.
Yes, because the cynicism, as you rightly point out, it was almost pathological in the 1920s and 30s. The idea that people could take charge of their destiny in some way, that they could fight the great forces around us, the forces of evil, that the individual really mattered. All of that had become undone in the trenches and the mechanized slaughter of the First World War. And so they refuse to give in to that cynicism. And they are so deliberate in their writings. What do? They take this idea of the epic quest, the epic hero, and they reinvent him for the modern mind like no one else was even trying to do. And they executed that through their writings in ways that were just so powerful and resonant. And also, Eric, how they were describing in their stories the fight, the struggle against evil and the darkness, it seemed to be confirmed by their life experience in the Second World War. And I think it's part of the reason their works have such a resonance. It speaks to the modern condition. So their heroes are not two-dimensional heroes. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about Frodo and Sam, the struggle as they're on the way to Mordor. I mean, at the end, without spoiler alert for your audience,
right.
I mean, Frodo, in a sense, fails in his quest. He succeeds, but he fails. The ring is mine, and puts it back on his finger,
yeah.
right? And then it's Gollum who yeah. bites the ring,
yeah.
falls into the cracks of doom. So as Tolkien described that, a sudden miraculous grace is what rescues all of Middle-earth. A sudden miraculous grace.
Boy, that really...
That's Tolkien's words, not mine.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it's also... I mean, I think the reason his work has such appeal is that it you know it's right.
Yes.
In other words, you know it has to be grace.
Yes.
Hard as we might try, in the end, we definitely will fail
yes.
apart from
yes.
grace.
Yes.
And so when you read that, you go, yes.
There's no triumphalism here. It's the lowly, frightened, indecisive hobbit who'd rather be in the comfort of his hobbit hole and rather not leave it.
Mm.
And boy, does that relate to you or me? I don't know about your hobbit hole. I kind of like
oh
mine.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Well, it really is interesting because it does, maybe you can answer the question, but the question to me is why did the two of them stand as they did when nearly everyone else did not, could not, was not willing to? I mean, again, you think of the intellectual tradition, you can go all the way back to Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach. This cynicism about faith
yeah.
that was there you know, already with the Victorians, and it carries on, obviously, into yeah. the 20th century. And it's corrosive,
yes.
it's pernicious. And so to get to World War II
yes.
and to somehow, yes. despite all of that,
yes.
be able to stand the,
yes.
the way they did, not triumphantly, as you said,
right.
nonetheless heroically,
yes.
what do you think it was about these two... men, or do you think that their friendship was part of that? Because it is so yes. hard to stand alone.
Yes, I think that's exactly part of the answer. I don't think either of those men could have accomplished what they did in the literary works without the help and encouragement of each other. And Tolkien is very explicit about this. He says in several of his letters, for a time, C.S. Lewis was his only audience for The Lord of the Rings, and he read out virtually every chapter to C.S. Lewis
wow.
and to the Inklings of The Lord of the Rings in composition. And Lewis is always saying, give me more, Tollers, give me more, you can do better, right?
How amazing. I mean, we just have to say, how amazing
yes.
to have a friend that would encourage
yes.
you and that the whole world has benefited
That's right.
as a result
That's right.
of the encouragement of C.S. Lewis to his friend. That's a big deal.
That's right. He says explicitly, I never would have brought it to a completion without the encouragement of C.S. Lewis. He never would have finished the work without him. And I think that's probably true.
Mm.
I think there's another quality here, and is a quote from C.S. Lewis. After Tolkien finishes writing The Lord of the Rings, the manuscript, Lewis has the manuscript. And he says, I've drunk the rich cup to the bottom. And he says, I'm going to try to quote it from memory. He says, now, so much of your whole life, Tolkien, writing to Tolkien now, talking about The Lord of the Rings, so much of your whole life, so much of our joint life, so much of the war is now, in a way, made permanent. I mean, do we even grasp what he's saying? I think he's saying somehow hidden in the pages of The Lord of the Rings is something of their shared journey together, because they lived through this absolute cataclysm of the Second World War, and they lived it together in friendship, in fellowship.
Mm.
And Lewis is saying explicitly, that work reflects our shared toil, our shared loves, our shared sacrifice, our friendship. It's hidden in the pages of Lord of the Rings. Wow.
That's a big deal. That's a big deal. Okay, so the title of the book is The War for Middle Earth.
Yes.
Remind us again of the subtitle. You say a lot in the subtitle.
Yes, J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis confront the gathering storm, 1933 to 1945. I remember when you were announcing me in the first book, I did a talk in the first book, the subtitle was so long. I think you used the phrase interminably long. But I'm not bitter about it. I really have gotten over it. I just want you to know.
That's the funny thing about subtitles, right?
You got come on, you can do it. Come on.
You got that colon.
There's plenty of room on the page. Come on.
You got the colon, and you can just go
with it,
and nobody's
going to
stop you.
Yeah.
Where do you go with this in the book? I haven't read the book yet. It's not out as we're having this conversation. Where do you take this?
I'm starting pre-1933. I want to give a little kind of recap of the post-World War I trauma, disillusionment, the shell-shocked veteran is really a walking metaphor for the European mind in the 1920s, right? The anti-heroism, which is almost pathological. So I want to give some of that cultural background, but also political background.
Yeah.
Hitler in 1925, the first installment of Mein Kampf is published in 1925. This is the year that Tolkien and Lewis are actually back at Oxford for the first time in that first year. They're coming back as instructors. It's that year that Mein Kampf appears. So there's things are beginning to happen in the 20s. I want to give some of that background, some of their friendship. But then 1933 on is where I spend the bulk of the book. And I'm almost taking it month to month at some points. So I'll give you an example, if I could. 1942, for example, in the spring. Yes, America is in the war, Pearl Harbor. But, Eric, we're not prepared for the Second World War. And we're getting our butts kicked by the Japanese in the Pacific, as the Brits are as well. And it's one failure, one surrender, one disaster after another. All of Europe is in Nazi hands. The Soviets are doing their thing. And now the Japanese are running amok in the Pacific. And it looks like in the first part of 1942, like civilization is on the edge of a knife. If we could quote from Lady Galadriel, your quest stands upon the edge of a knife. Stray but a little and it will fail to the ruin of all. That's 1942 in the spring. And in that moment, and this is what I try to do in the book, is contextualize. In that moment, Tolkien is stuck. He can't write anymore The Lord of the Rings. And he's fallen into kind of a gloom. And he wakes up one morning, he says, and out comes a short story called Leaf by Niggle. It's considered the most autobiographical. It's about a painter named Niggle who is painting this great canvas, this great tree, and he can't finish it. And it came out fully formed. And biographers would say, this really looks like a self, kind of a self-medication. You know, he's treating himself emotionally by writing this story. He's feeling mortality. He's feeling the shortness of the tether, if I could borrow from C.S. Lewis. Mm. The curtain's coming down. I think he's just turned 50. He's turned 50 in 1942. So he's feeling mortality. He doesn't think he's going to finish The Lord of the Rings. And he writes Leaf by Niggle, and it's an incredibly beautiful story.
Leaf by Niggle, I don't remember too much about it, but I remember loving it. It's one of those great stories that I think, man, this
profoundly
is...
redemptive,
yeah,
transcendent message. And it helps to bring him out of the gloom.
Yeah.
And with Lewis's encouragement as well, he gets on with his story.
Yeah.
So I'm taking it through at certain points, almost month by month, what is going on as they're saying various things, as they're meeting, a journal entry here, a journal entry there. I'll give you another example, if you don't mind. 1941 December. J.R.R. Tolkien would write these Christmas letters, Father Christmas letters. You've probably seen the collection, perhaps, of the book of them, when his kids were really small, but he kept doing them. Father Christmas. These letters would arrive in the mail, illustrated by Tolkien. Whimsical, you know, fun, funny. The polar bear adventures with Father Christmas. Well, you know what he's writing in 1941? Can I read you a few lines?
Please.
From December? Could I just do that?
Yeah.
I think I'll find it pretty quickly here. Here it is. To his daughter Priscilla, December of 1941. We've just entered the war, but we're not ready. You know, the Americans. And all of Europe is in Nazi hands, and Britain's hanging by a thread. This is what Father Christmas writes to Priscilla. I expect you remember that some years ago we had trouble with the goblins, and we thought we had settled it. Well, it broke out again this autumn, worse than it's been for centuries. So terribly many people have lost their homes or have left them. Half the world seems in the wrong place. This is Father Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, kids.
Merry Christmas, kids. Half the world's in the wrong place. He's talking about life as it is. Father Christmas cannot avoid the reality of the horror of what's going on. And I think somebody needed to kind of write a book that helped us to understand what these men are enduring, what they're going through as they're carrying on with their great vocations as Christian authors and scholars. So I took a stab at it.
Part of what's interesting, when you mention Hitler writing the first part of Mein Kampf in 1925,
yes.
What's interesting is that all of Europe, the United States not quite so much, but Europe, Western Europe, is in despair. There's cynicism, economic... agony. And it's interesting how Hitler provides huge hope for millions, which we just happen to know ends up not working out so well. But it's so interesting how people are looking for something.
Yes.
And then that's, of course, the question.
Yes.
Is what you take as the answer good or evil?
Yes.
Is it in New York right now? You know, a lot of people are struggling, and essentially a communist with a big smile may win the mayoralty of this. And it's a very similar thing. You know, you promise hope and change, and you smile, and people say, "Well, hey, well, you know, where does it go?"
Yes,
and of course, we know that. There's nothing new here, that there were
exactly
charismatic
right.
figures in the past. And
that's
the question is, you know, we don't want to condemn being charismatic.
Sure.
We don't want to condemn populism. We don't want to, what we want is to know, is it the good kind or other kind?
That's right. And what centers us? What is our moral center is part of the question.
Yeah.
I mean, it was Mussolini, as you well know, who first introduced fascism into the European bloodstream. 1922. My grandfather got out of Italy in 1921. He was 17 years old. Nice timing, Grandpa Aiello. That's the Aiello side of the family. Great timing. Left Italy and never really looked back. So what was Mussolini promising to the Italian people, who were on the winning side of the war but still devastated? Italians lost 500,000 people. 500,000 people they lost in the First World War, with not much to show for it. So there's a sense of also gloom, disillusionment with the Italians. Here comes Mussolini, right? Regained Italian glory and honor and all the rest of it. So what's the moral grounding of the charismatic leader in the case of a Hitler, of a Mussolini, of a Stalin? And this is totalitarianism. And what are they all promising, Eric? They're promising a kind of utopian society. Every aspiration will be met in us, in the state. In the state. We will be the fulfillment of your deepest longings and aspirations. You will be absorbed. You will serve the state, but you will also find your own even spiritual fulfillment in the state. Incredible.
Now, what's interesting, of course, to us as Americans is that Americans ought to be inoculated against that.
Yes.
Because we have a history where we know that fulfillment in the state, not going to work. We know. I mean, it's an amazing thing that 250 years ago we understood this and we formulated this. And it does come out of the Christian tradition. That's not debatable. It's fascinating to me that so we in America, that the siren song that many in Europe, because Europe was already post-Christian enough not maybe to see where this could go.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. I think there was a the forces of secularization had worked pretty deeply into many, many layers of European society, and the Christian churches, you could argue, had become become ineffective, anemic. They couldn't stand up against the world. They just didn't have the wherewithal, the moral, spiritual wherewithal to stand up against the world. They were accommodating. And, of course, they also had a relationship with their own state governments, unlike the United States, right?
Well,
state religions.
You wrote a book about Churchill and the... I don't remember the title of that book that you wrote, where about the theologically liberal pastors in Europe, their inability to stand.
The End of Illusions, yeah.
Yep.
The End of Illusions book, that's right. That's right. The liberal theologians who just couldn't see what was happening, wouldn't see what was happening.
Well, say a little bit about that, because it's fascinating to me. You know, when people say something is Christian, you know, you want to know, at least I do, is it really, or does it just claim to be? And the liberal theologians that you write about in The End of Illusions, they failed in the way that Tolkien and Lewis succeeded.
Yes.
They didn't take their faith to the bottom. It was
That's right.
was a kind of a they hadn't, it seems to me, worked out their faith in the way that it needs to be worked out to confront evil.
Yes, yes. And they had a biblical anthropology, if we could use a $25 word. They had a view of the human person that was rooted in Genesis. Man made in the image of God, bearing incredible dignity, but deeply fallen. And yes, there's the memory of Eden, but it's a memory. So we have the aspirations for Eden, aspirations for heaven, but we're cut off from the source of life. And both men believe that deeply. I mean, Tolkien says explicitly in some of his letters, my story is about the fall. All good, great stories are about the fall. He just says it, the Lord of the Rings, right? Lewis says it throughout his works. In the Screwtape Letters, there's a place where he says one of his installments, in Mere Christianity, in the broadcasts, one of the installments is called The Invasion. The Invasion. And then he takes the example of the Second World War, and he uses it as a metaphor for the spiritual invasion. And he says, we live in rebel-occupied territory. Rebel meaning the devil. We are occupied by the dark forces. We need to be part of the resistance, he says. This is a broadcast over the BBC in 1941-42. Right? We are living in occupied territory. We need to be part of the resistance. So they were acutely aware of the spiritual dimension to life, which I think these other, the liberal theologians, not so much.
Not so much, right. Well, it's interesting because this is something that's come to interest me particularly in recent years. You know, when someone says, I'm a Christian, at this point, I've come to the conclusion that I know that that means absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. Because these are just words, you know. And Lewis and Tolkien... They were the real thing, and I think that their ability to produce these epic works, these great works that have lasted as though they have, it really proves it in a way.
Yes. Yes, I think their works will last as long as the English language lasts. They're so beautifully written. They're so powerful. They're so imbued with moral purpose and dignity, moral beauty. There's nothing like them, I think. There's nothing like them in modern literature.
I think of, whenever I think of Perelandra, I think that it ought to be taught as a sequel to Paradise Lost. It seems to me to be so much written like a sequel to Paradise Lost, and it's great. And you can't, if you understand the world and you understand the fall and the redemption, if you understand all that, You realize everything's about that because reality is about that, because it is not escapable.
Yes.
There's no other reality where you can effectively write and not deal with that.
Yes. And it seems to me to live through the war years, 1939, 1945, and not come to the conclusion that there's something deeply wrong in human nature. You have your head in the sand. And these men did not have their heads in the sand. They are realists. They're often accused, at least then during the day, and even now, you'll have some modern critics accuse them of escapism. Escapism.
Yeah.
I mean, think about Plato's cave, the analogy of the cave. What is Plato trying to do? He's trying to awaken the moral imagination, isn't he? Just to help people see. You think these shadows are reality. They're not reality. Come out into the sunlight. That's what they're trying to do with their incredible epic works. Pierce through the darkness. Get out of the cave and see reality, the human condition in all of its frailty, right? And all of its tragedy.
And the classic example of that from Lewis is in The Silver Chair. Mm. When Prince Caspian, isn't he down in a cave someplace? And they're trying to convince him that there is no such thing as the sun and the moon and the stars.
That's right. And whatever. It's right out of Plato.
And it is. And of course, it's powerful. And anybody reading rooting for him to wake up.
Yes.
You're rooting for him to wake up to the reality so he can fight. And
That
The Silver Chair is such a great book. Sometimes I would say that it has to be my favorite of the Narnia Chronicles.
Really?
But it's I didn't. You mentioned not having read Lord of the Rings until later in life. I never read the Narnia Chronicles until I was in my early 30s, I think.
Yeah.
And they're clearly, as far as I'm concerned, clearly meant for adults.
Absolutely.
Even though kids can read them. But wow.
Yes, that's right.
What? I can't think of anything as great as the Narnia Chronicles.
I mean, can you think of any other authors who can communicate such profound truths about the human condition through literature in ways that are so compelling and speak across generations, right, across cultures? They have this universal appeal. I interviewed Neil Ferguson, the great British historian, a couple of years back about this whole project. And, Neil Ferguson is a fascinating guy, brilliant historian. And he said that he feared for our civilization if these books could not be read and embraced by the next generation of children. That's how important they were in identifying these basic truths and holding up these high ideals. He feared for our civilization if they couldn't be passed on, the Chronicles of Narnia, right?
Well, the thing is, we have to acknowledge how rare they are. You know, it's kind of like saying, okay, forget about Shakespeare. Who else we got? There's nothing to compare. There's nobody writing when Shakespeare is writing to compare to Shakespeare. There's Shakespeare, and then there's not much.
Yeah.
When I think of Lewis or Tolkien, who else you got? It's a
small list. It's a short list.
It's a gift. I mean, that's what I'm saying. These figures
are
such a gift. I mean, you think, what if George Washington hadn't been born? Who you got? Would we have prevailed in the revolution?
That's an excellent question. Yes,
almost certainly not.
Yes.
So that's really the
yes. It's if Washington was the indispensable man, as you know from our time, our struggle. It seemed like these two men were the indispensable men for Oxford in the 1930s and 40s to help make Oxford and beyond a beachhead of resistance against the forces of darkness. It's hard to imagine the world. The literary world, and maybe our own world, without them, without their contribution.
Oh, our own world.
Right?
No, our own world for sure. What is the phrase that you mentioned when you talked about, Gollum's biting off the finger of the ring? And
The ring is mine.
The grace.
Oh, a sudden miraculous grace.
Right.
That's Tolkien's phrase. Yeah. Catastrophe was the expression he created.
Yeah. The sudden...
Miraculous grace.
Miraculous grace... I would say, talking to you, that the advent of Lewis and Tolkien and their friendship and the production of these works is God's miraculous grace to save us from what we might have fallen into. That they are, in the real world, an analog of that moment in Tolkien's epic.
Wow, that may well be right. And what it brings to mind is a line from Lewis to Tolkien. describing the impact of the Lord of the Rings on his life. He says, I think I got this quote exactly right. He says, "My entire philosophy of history is summed up in a single sentence of your own." Do you want to know the sentence? I'm not going to tell your audience. I'm sorry. I have to go now. It's summed up in a single sentence. My entire philosophy of history is summed up in a single sentence. It's a line from Lord of the Rings. "There was sorrow then too, and gathering dark, but great valor and great deeds that were not wholly vain."
Mm.
And what is he saying? There's a moral realism. He's navigating between cynicism and utopianism. The tragedy of the human condition, but there are things worth doing in this world, Frodo. Right? We got to get into the fight. And the little hobbit, the little hands of the little hobbit, these are the wheels that turn the world.
Mm.
Right.
Well, I guess it sort of reminds me of the last line of Middlemarch about, you know, the people who lie in unmarked graves who've done great things.
Yes, yes.
It's at the heart of everything.
Yes.
You are, I should say to the audience, in case they're wondering, because there's a lot of people who write about a lot of stuff, and the ideas are great, but the writing is not necessarily great. You write in such a way that is really compelling. Anybody listening to you talk or any student you've had in your classes would know this, but that's very important. And
thank
so
you.
I want my audience to know that
these
books are actually fun to read and wonderful. And so
thank you,
I will simply say congratulations on the new book, The War for Middle Earth. And thank you, Joe, so much for this time. It's been a delight.
Thank you, Eric. What a pleasure. Thank you, sir.